March 25th, 1971, Pioneer Hall, Pioneer Museum, the Tano Yukon Historical Society monthly meeting. Our guest this evening is Dr. Arthur Scheibel, a longtime physician at Fairbanks.
I hope I have something to contribute. Okay. Did you want me to call this pattern as you
just
outlined
the
here?
Pattern, and I think it's better if you do the talking and the questions are written down.
The first question was, where was I born? So if you'll just hold this up, I think I can best explain that. This is a map of the southern part of Africa. And this is the Cape of Good Hope. I was born 1,000 miles north of Cape Town at a little fishing village, Walvis Bay. It sits on the desert, this is all desert, in an enclave which belonged to Great Britain. The surrounding territory was German. We spoke English at home. My father was an American. My father was from Michigan. My mother, however, was born there. My mother was educated in the Cape Town area. My mother was the daughter of my father's predecessor, who was an explorer missionary after the tradition and a contemporary of Livingston. He was the first white man in the Kaaka Belt. This is the Skeleton Coast area, a very rather forbidding area here. They call it the Skeleton Coast because it is strewn not only with human skeletons, but skeletons of ships. You're shipwrecked here. You do get ashore. There's no water. Once you are through this barrier of desert, you do get a plateau, and then wild game, and then there is farming and ranching here. So I was there until about age 14. But before that, perhaps I can tell you a little bit about this. At age 6, I was getting of school age, and Walvis Bay at that time, there was no road such as you see here. It was absolutely isolated. Nobody wanted this country here. They gave it to Bismarck. Great Britain didn't want it. They took the seaport. They scrambled for territories, and Great Britain took what they wanted, and Germany could have that. And so there was no school there. There were 500 Hottentots and 30 white people. And so I was sent to school by donkey cart to this community that the Germans tried to build. I could speak no German, and I started out in 1914 in a German school, not understanding a word of German. August the 4th came along, and I just recall the teacher having received a wireless message. There was a wireless station there at the little larger community. Had the children stand up, sing a patriotic song, and I gathered that war had been declared, Germany and England. And very shortly thereafter, my father sent a donkey cart along the beach. And in those days, it took all day. And it took me back. And a day or two after that, well, I know, I think it was a little longer than that. Two men of war steamed up here after I was safely in Walvis Bay, and I could still hear, I can still to this day hear the bombing of Swakopmund. Of course, we thought it was worse than it really was. All they were doing was bombing the wireless station. Well, that's enough of that. At age 14 in 1921, and incidentally almost exactly to the day, 50 years ago, after I finally went to school down here, we went back to Michigan. I think that's enough of that.
Go ahead.
We've come to the United States now. We went to Cape Town and then took a steamer to Southampton, and then the Aquitania across to New York, and then the train from New York to Michigan, and then Michigan, went to school in Michigan, and we of course stayed in this country then. I went to school in Elmhurst College, Elmhurst, Illinois, and then to Northwestern Medical School in Chicago. And I graduated from there in 1934 and had a year's internship at Charity Hospital of Louisiana in 1935. I stayed on there 36 and 37, interested in surgery. And 38, I was a reserve in the Army at Walter Reed Hospital. And while I was there, I was assigned to the officer's ward, and we also had congressmen on this particular ward as patients, and also high government officials. And one of them was a Mr. Fechner, who was head of the Civilian Conservation Corps, and he had just returned from Alaska. And I talked to him about Alaska, and he said something about Fairbanks. "Just a village, my boy," he said. "They just had a very bad flood." But he said, "I think it has possibilities." And I was on a reserve status in the Army, but of course I was a bachelor. The pay wasn't very good. And other congressmen had junkets up in Alaska, and whenever I heard about it, I talked to them about Alaska. And then someone said, "Why don't you go down and see Dr. So-and-so in the Department of the Interior? He'll put you in charge of a government hospital someplace in Alaska, and you'll get double the salary you're getting here. You'll be in charge." And it sounded like a good idea to me, and I did just that. He had a map of Alaska on the wall. He said, "I can send you to Point Barrow and put you in charge there. I can send you to Tanana," and one or two other choices. And it didn't make much difference to me, but I chose Tanana. And so on September the 19th or 20th, I passed through Fairbanks. I drove across country in my car and left my car in Seattle and took the boat up. And we had a flood on a train coming up, and it took, as I recall it, it took about 3 weeks to get me to, with all the delays, to get me to Fairbanks, and spent 2 days here. And Herman Lerdahl with Weens flew me out to Tanana September the 21st, 1938. Found that I'd be in charge of a hospital, 30 beds, took care of the natives in the interior of Alaska. The area covered would be the Lower Yukon, Nulato, Caltag, Ruby, Galena, and then the Upper Yukon. The Fort Yukon Hospital was not in operation at the time, so I would get that area, and I'd have to visit all those areas up as far as Eagle and Alatna, Alatakut, and then the Tanana, then the Besna, Tetlin, upper reaches of the Tanana. And I would not only visit those places, they would bring patients in to me. I found the hospital, a 30-bed hospital, about 30 employees, four nurses, aides. I don't think there were quite 30 employees. When I left, there were probably about 30. When I first got there, I don't think there were that many, probably about 15 or so when I first came there. I had an interest in surgery, which many others were very good doctors did not have. So I would, whenever I made my field trips, whenever I saw a tumor or a hernia, I asked them to come down to the hospital, and I found there was quite a backlog of surgery which had been accumulating over the years. So I did quite a bit of surgery. And I found I had to be quite versatile because there was no one to help me. And there were some procedures that I had to review. And so I couldn't consult with anyone. Communications weren't so good, so when if I had a patient that expired, I remember one particular occasion, I asked the family's permission, and the cadaver was brought down to the cellar basement. This was the old hospital before we built the new, and I performed a practice operation on the mastoid, and I did that with several other operations before I did them on the living subject. And I think the patients really appreciated that. We had to be resourceful. Sometimes we didn't have the best of equipment. It would take too long to get it there. We just improvised it. We didn't have any fancy surgery lights. We strung up some electric light bulbs and did just as well. When I made my field trips, I'd go into a village, say like Nebesna, and go into the schoolroom, and the field nurse helping me, I would do, say, six tonsillectomies on these children under local anesthesia, and compare that to the procedure today. The patient goes in a day in advance, is visited by the anesthesiologist the night before, spends a night in the hospital. The next morning is run through a battery of tests, and then spends the next day very often in the hospital. So things have changed a lot. the anesthesia at the hospital was either local, that is, injection local, or it was an abdominal operation, was under spinal anesthesia, or drop ether. We had no gas machine or anything like that. And drop ether was safe, and we could do almost anything. I know, I remember one of the school teachers came in and had a cesarean section under a spinal, I think from Stevens Village. Modes of travel, airplane, floats in the summer, ski in winter, some wheel. The skis, the landing field was cleared right in front of the hospital. The hospital was right on the banks of the Yukon. And Sam Heater had a small cat, caterpillar, would level off the ice. The ice would freeze up very rough, and he'd level off a strip. And the Pan American plane, the mail plane that would fly from Fairbanks to Nome three times a week, delivering with the mail. The second class mail would come by dog team. Ambrose Kozelnikov would bring it just as regular as clockwork every Saturday afternoon. He'd come in about 3:30 or 4 o'clock. He brought it the last lap from Manly Hot Springs to Tanana. And our social life, Saturday nights, that was magazine night in the hospital. You couldn't, there was no bridge or anything like that. That's when you read, you caught up on your Time or whatever magazine you had. I forgot to mention that the hospital building, the old one, was part of the old Fort Gibbon military fort. I think it was the old Signal Corps building. And that particular hospital was replaced in after I'd been there about a year and a half. I supervised the construction of a new and larger hospital, which is still there today. Now, Fort Gibbon, as you know, was abandoned in 1925, I believe, and I think it had its... It began, I think, at the turn of the century. You know, Tanana, at one time, the people thought it was destined to be quite a community, being at the confluence of the Tanana and Yukon rivers. At one time, they thought they would be the terminus of the Alaska Railroad. I remember, I think, Joe Anisich there, who had the famous Tower House, showing me the headlines of a newspaper that was published there, in which the news had sifted down to Tanana, that Tanana would be the terminus instead of Fairbanks of the Alaska Railroad. So I suppose the reasoning was that the Yukon, being deeper riverboat navigation, would be more constant and steady, because the Tanana is there are too many bars in the Tanana, and waiting sometimes for the boats to come down from Nenana was very uncertain thing. They could never keep a schedule. The sandbars, the bars would forever be shifting. It may be all right with a small boat like George Black had, but when the Nenana here, And incidentally, I used to ride that Nenana. I made my rounds on that Nenana. I used to see patients on that Nenana. I never actually held clinics there on the Nenana, but I used to visit different communities on the Nenana, and then when I'd stop at a community, occasionally a patient would see me, and then I would see them on the steamer Nenana. Dog team. Yes, we did some travel by dog team. But it was mostly from the airplane to the hospital. The hospital had its own little team. It was fed mostly with leftover scraps, supplemented with a little fish. And it really wasn't a very good team. I entered it in the races there, but I think I was the joke of the community. I always carried the lantern. I was always last. And I did take it 20 miles down the river once, and I got home, and I think that was something. And of course, the dog teams were the mainstay for the trapping, and there were many more fish wheels than they are now because they had to keep those dogs supplied with fish. While I was there, I imported the first automobile. It was a Ford station, yellow Ford station wagon, and to this day I'll see many people who will tell me the first automobile they had was in that yellow station wagon that I brought to Tanana. And along that same line, I also sent out to Sears Roebuck and got an electric phonograph. And before that, this was 1939, before that the phonographs were all hand winding type. And this gave wonderful amplification, something that hadn't been heard before, and made quite a hit too. And of course, right about that time, beer barrel poker came out. And that record was just played to death, and that made a big hit.
I might ask you a couple of questions at this point. What did your father do in Africa?
He was a missionary.
Oh, a missionary,
yes.
I see. And I missed the date of your birth. We would like to have that if we can, please.
November the 15th, 1906.
And another question, was medicine your chosen field initially, or did you start out in another career and then change career fields?
No, I chose that originally.
Originally.
Yes.
Your father wouldn't have been a medical missionary by any chance.
No.
And you're speaking of transportation. Now, Tetlin is difficult to get to today. In the 30s, it must have been nearly impossible to get to Tetlin.
Yes. Well, I still remember the schedule. On June the 10th, Ween would fly up with pontoons, and they would circle the village. Let's see, Nabesna, Tetlin. They would circle the village and then land in a lake close by. And then that was the signal for the natives to come up with a kicker. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't long, and they'd be in the lake. And then they'd haul me and my equipment back into the village.
Mm-hmm. Now, the many groups of Indians that you treated, were there any groups that were rather primitive? I associate the Tetlin Indians as being in a very remote part of Alaska. at least at that time?
They were the ones who were least exposed to the ways of the white people, yes.
Did, as a result of this, did they have the same amount of disease and problems, medical problems, as the others, or less or more?
Well, of course, they had had some exposure. Hermann Kessler and John, the trader, and John Hajdukovic were there, and the public health nurse, Miss Wright, had been up there. I remember one interesting thing about those natives up there. I found a high incidence of colloid goiter. Well, there were six or seven cases, which was quite high because all within just a year or two, and they needed surgery. And whether that's because they were inland and didn't get enough iodine, I can't. I don't know.
In that general area, there's Mentasta, and I've read in the newspapers in the last 10 years or so several natives that have lived to be in the 100 years of age, possibly more, plus or minus. Of course, these are allegations. And did you find many of the natives living in the communities you served to be very old, or were they just the exceptions? Obviously, they'd be exceptions, but...
I really don't recall the age distribution of the natives there.
Well, you were a real pioneer at Tananaw in the medical field, and having served the peoples along the river. Now, what year did you come to Fairbanks?
In 1941.
And were you with the Public Health Service at that time?
No. No, I joined the Fairbanks Clinic. Dr. Gillespie. I more or less took Dr. Gillespie's place. Dr. Gillespie and Dr. Haglund. Dr. Dick, Dr. Noble Dick. And we were there all during the war. I was just remarking to my nurse today how times have changed. When I came to Alaska, my salary was $400 a month. And now I think our receptionist gets more than that. And when I went to the clinic, my salary was $500 a month, starting at the clinic. The times have changed a lot since then. Of course, then office calls were $3. That has all changed.
I imagine the method of treatment has changed also.
Yes, yes. Now, tuberculosis, of course, was quite a scourge. And the surgery I did was directed towards alleviation of tuberculosis, the crushing of the phrenic nerve, scalene here to put the lung at rest, pneumothorax, which would be putting air in the chest cavity to rest the lung. Well, now, of course, chemotherapy has taken over, and we don't see nearly the tuberculosis. Of course, I'm not in that field so much anymore, but the general health of the natives in that respect has improved tremendously.
Mm-hmm. And I presume on the white population also.
Yes, yes.
I imagine in your career as a doctor, in Fairbanks in particular, that accidents have been a have been a large percentage of your treatment?
No.
Industrial accidents and...
No, that, I'm a, my field is, I'm a general surgeon. I do urology and gynecology and general surgery, and I've taken care of some accidents, but that really isn't my field.
Were you a partner initially in the new clinic, or I believe that you're eventually established the clinic, or a clinic? In partnership with, was it Dr. Haglund? Or?
Yes. Well, no. This presently, the Fairbanks Medical and Surgical Clinic was established in 1932. And I believe Dr. Carter, Dr. Gillespie, and Dr. Dick formed that. And I came then in 1941, became a partner. Well, I worked on a salary in 1942, became a partner in 1943. The present medical center building, which houses the present clinic, is, I believe, they're mostly, if I may be modest enough to say so, mostly through my endeavors.
Mm-hmm. Now, where was the initial clinic when you...
That was over the... I understand the first one was in the railroad area near the where the News Miner building is now. And then they moved to above the First National Bank, before the First National Bank was enlarged. And then about 1949, it moved to the old Legion building, which is on 4th Avenue across the street from the present Medical Center building.
Mm-hmm. And do you still have plans of enlarging it, the clinic?
Yes.
Well, I believe you've compared, to some extent, medical treatments as they were then and as they are now. Now, I think in the community that you've also made contributions to education. Were you not on the...
Yes. The Board of Regents, yes. Yes, at the university, yes.
What period?
Yes.
Were you?
My term expired last year, and I was on for 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
the university.
I was also on the Board of Health. I believe for 2 4-year terms. This the Territorial Board of Health. And also on the Medical Board of Examiners. I believe Governor Greening appointed me.
Well, you, Chris, have developed a fine clinic, and I presume that you were instrumental in possibly the development of the university during your 8-year term, because the university surely grew, or at least its physical plant surely grew during that period of time.
Well, we're fortunate that we have very fine staff, very fine men on the university, Dr. Wood, and men like I see here, one of your very good members, Bill Cashin, men like that who make the university tick.
Now, you've been active in medicine and education, and I believe you're also active in the business community and various business endeavors. You're associated with the bank, and you're chairman of the board, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And you must lead a very, very full life, and both of those are very time-consuming activities.
Well... The bank is only a Thursday morning thing, and it only concerns policy. I have nothing to do with the day-to-day management of the bank. Matter of fact, I couldn't balance my own checkbook. My wife has to do that. I'd probably make a mistake. And it's just a policy that we're concerned with. And we just meet for 2 hours every Thursday morning. And there too, we have a good president now. We're very happy. We're very happy with him.
Well, of course, that's a very important function, is to select, should I say, followers, since I believe you're the leader, to select good followers.
Oh, thank you.
Good supervisors, managers. Did you purchase a bank, or your interest in the bank, from Cap Lathrop, or were you associated with him in any way?
Yes, but the newsminer had it wrong when they said I purchased it. It's not quite right. I have a small percentage. Phil Johnson, actually, who was managing the bank at the time, did the negotiating. I happened to be fishing with Phil, and we were coming home from a very successful fishing trip. And Phil said, Art, I believe Cap would sell his bank. Would you be interested? And I didn't know anything about it, and I said, well, I think so. And he said, well, do you think you could scrape up $20,000? And, you know, I was new, and I'd been saving my money, and I just happened to have that. And the next day, he saw me that fast and asked for the check, and gave it to Cap, and that was the honest money for buying the bank. And he saw me that afternoon and said, we just bought a bank.
Well, what year was that? What year was that?
I think that was in 47 or 48, long 49?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the bank, of course, has continued to grow since that time.
Yes.
Fairbanks has.
Yes.
Getting back to medicine, I'm sure that in the field of medicine that a town like Fairbanks doesn't have all the resources that a university hospital would have, for instance, and yet the doctors are called upon to perform operations with limited equipment and perform medical techniques through improvising, since resources just aren't available here, and I'm sure that you must have had your share.
That is true. One must be resourceful and do the best you can and still do the best for the patient.
I've sort of exhausted my questions, and I'm wondering if Professor Cashin, and
well, I think your book covered the subject quite well. I'm intrigued there of the detail and the good coverage that you've done so far. It occurred to me, though, on this last question, this airplane 6-hour flight must make a big difference in medical practice too, doesn't it, Doctor? In the sense that you're not exactly alone facing all these situations, that in the real rough ones, you know you're within 2 hours.
It does help, and also the communications, the telephone. I mean, now we can, better still, we can call Seattle and get a consultation and get advice. That means a lot. But in the old days, you couldn't do any of that, you know. Yeah.
Take a week or so to send them out.
Yeah.
Longer than that.
Yeah.
And Dr. Van Essen?
Have they started the service to the villages by radio when you were 10 and all?
Yes, yes.
But
we did not have it in Tanana, though. They had something like that, I think, in Kotzebue and in Bethel. But we did not have it in Tanana, not the radio service, no.
I was wondering, too, did you find the natives interested in learning to be nurses, or were there any capable of it?
Yes, some of them did, and some of them did go on. Yes, and they make good. They do well.
The native people did most of the cooking in the.
They did all the cooking.
Practical.
Yes.
Work.
Yes. Yes. Mr. Southall.
Dr. Hill performed the first stomach operation in Alaska, and will.
Yes. Well, I performed some stomach operations in, there are stomach operations and there are stomach operations. I think you mean when you take the stomach out, a gastrectomy. In 1942, I did a gastrectomy in St. Joseph's Hospital. And I was able to compare notes. I know that none had been done in Fairbanks area here, and I was able to compare notes with doctors in Juneau and Anchorage, and I know none had been done there. And that's also true of thyroidectomy and prostatectomy had not been done, at least not up here.
Well, I presume to keep current at that particular time, at least in the field of medicine, that you must have had to do a great deal of studying during your career. Being isolated, for instance, at Tanana, no communications with other doctors, and you must have done a great deal of reading on the subject to maintain a currency.
Well, I suppose that's true, and in anything you want to do, you always must keep your tools sharp.
Yes. Frank, I'm sorry.
Are members of your family still living in Africa?
My mother's sisters married South Africans, and they, of course, are still there. But none of my father's family, of course, are.
Frank, I'm wondering if you can have any questions.
No, I don't think so, but I enjoyed the doctor's naming off the old timers I used to know in Tanana. Years ago, I had a mail contract, you know, going from Fairbanks to Wiseman. Tanana used to be one of my chief stopping points. I knew all those names that you mentioned.
Joe Anisich?
Oh, yeah.
Austrian Joe?
Yeah.
His parrot, probably had his parrot.
Yeah,
Joe had a four-story tower house he was very proud of. And it actually had a tower, which was a beacon. And, of course, a lot of boat traffic in those days, and he hoped to draw people from all over the Yukon with this tower. And then, of course, his parrot was very, very famous. Of course, a lot of the boarders there, this roadhouse, he ran this roadhouse, a lot of the boarders objected to his parrot because he kept the cage right in the middle of a round table, and he very often didn't clean the cage.
Yes.
When we first went there, the old Signal Corps building had quarters right in this large building, and there were still some of the Army quarters there if you wanted it, from the army, and some that was also available for some. And then later, when the new hospital was built, quarters were built also.
Now those are registered nurses that were working there. You said there were
yes,
four when you
yes,
there.
Yes. There were three, and then another one came. There were four altogether.
Okay.
One was a field nurse. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Scheibel, I'm sure that we've overlooked something in.
Well, I think that one of the best stories that I've heard my husband tell is about sort of an unscheduled flight with Bart LaRue. Now we should tell the story.
Well, perhaps I should first tell who Bart LaRue is. I think some of you know Bart LaRue. He was a irascible, lovable dentist in the Yukon country. And he would work quite hard. He'd go to a village and performed a wonderful service with his dentistry. And he'd work quite hard, but when he was through working, he would imbibe rather freely. And perhaps he would overdo it a little bit. And then he'd arrive at the next place and set up his equipment, and he wouldn't drink, and he'd work quite hard, and then when he was through, he'd start all over again. But I had made a field trip to Eagle, and in the summer, and I had caught a ride down the Yukon on the steamer Yukon, which was a passenger ship. And so we got to Fort Yukon, and there were many tourists on the ship, and I saw many of the native patients, and they had it all arranged for me to see them. I think the ship was in there 3 or 4 hours, and I got ready to go back. I think they were leaving about midnight, and as I was going, Bart LaRue stopped me and said, "You can't go on that." He said, "I have many of my friends, and they want to see a doctor, and I want you to see them." Well, I said, "My ship is leaving, and my boss is waiting for me in Tanana. He's come from Juneau, and he wants to see me, and I must leave." He said, "Don't worry. I've got my airplane on floats here, and I'll see that you catch up with the ship at the next port, or next place, which was Beaver. So don't you worry." So, all right. So, he had three or four of these old cronies, and I took care of them, and then I got through, and the ship sailed on, and I went around looking for Bart LaRue, and finally found him in a sort of abandoned hotel. He was upstairs sitting with some more old cronies, and it seems that that afternoon he had made a special trip over to Old Crow in Yukon Territory, and they had picked up a case of extra strong Hudson Bay rum. And here, that was my pilot. Well, I was a young man trying to make an impression on my boss, and I had to get there, and there was no other way. What could I do? So, I don't know. He seemed to walk all right, and I thought, all right, I'll ride with him. So he put me, he had a small plane, I don't know anything about planes, but he put me in the front, and he sat behind, and we took off, and we got going, and up in the air, and I didn't feel too secure, but pretty soon I could smell the fumes of Hudson Bay rum, and pretty soon he pokes me, and he says, "Take over the stick." I don't know, but I took the stick, and And I discovered that when you did something, the plane did this, and I learned to fly a plane. Well, we saw the Yukon, and then he dive-bombed it a few times, and all the passengers came out in their night clothing, woke them all up, and we finally landed in Beaver with a big splash. We landed there, and he could hardly walk out of the plane. But I got back to Tanana in time. It all ended well, so I suppose it was all right.
Do we have any more questions?
Yeah, you got it the hard way.
It was the longest flight you ever had.
I don't think I've been in a small plane since.
Do we have any more questions?
What about the mission at Tanana?
Oh.
Why was that allowed to deteriorate and fall down? I was there about a year ago, and I was impressed with what there was left of it.
Yeah. Well, they moved. All the natives apparently moved into town. And so they, when I was there, they were still out at the mission. Matter of fact, they were at one time were even thinking of having their own little hospital up there. But they have moved. There's a beautiful spot there. There's a beautiful spot. And they have moved. I don't know when, Shorty Files, Reverend Files, was the missionary there. I think his son is here someplace or at Fort Yukon.
I know Dorothy Pitka, who has a homestead near Tanana.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose her name wasn't Pitka when she was there, but
yeah.
She lives down on First Avenue.
Yeah.
But she's one of the few natives who has a 160-acre homestead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Doctor, this interview, I may refer to it as that, or taping, has gone very well, thanks to you. You brought notes. It was well planned.
Well, it's been a pleasure. The pleasure's been all mine.
Well, we're very pleased to have you, and these tapes, as you may or may not know, are put in storage at the university, and possibly 50 or 100 years from now, why some student will have the benefit of your experiences and hear your voice.
Thank you.
Thank you very kindly.